Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. Levi King, a spree killer, found peace when he murdered. The crimes he was ultimately convicted for gave him comfort and, in his own words, placed him in a euphoric state. In this episode, I will also share the story of the only person left in Levi King's destructive path. Okay, on to the show. Levi King was running away. He was tired of living life on the terms of others. When he was only 19 years old, he was sentenced to 14 years in prison for burglarizing his neighbor's home and then setting it on fire. Because of his good behavior, Levi only served 2.5 years. After his release from prison, he was required to live in a halfway home in St. Louis, Missouri. He abided by the check-in and check-out times, but an urge in him was bubbling to the surface. He wanted his freedom, and he wanted it on his terms. He made a plan to check out of the halfway home and travel to his father's home in Pineville, Missouri. Levi knew he could find a cache of weapons and ammunition there since his father was an avid gun collector. Pictures that were later taken of his father's home would make you think that you were looking at the inside of a pawn shop or a gun store. Knives and swords of all kinds were hung on the wall, while guns were kept in a safe or leaning against the wall, fully loaded. His father was surprised to see him, but not completely. He always had a hard time with Levi. The kid had a mind of his own and often got in trouble for following whatever path he wanted to. Scott King was no angel of a father. He raised Levi and his 5 siblings pretty much on his own. He provided a home with little to no amenities. They had exposed electrical cables that could have easily sparked a fire around the exposed insulation that had been hastily mounted to the walls. Scott led a no-rules household. The children could come and go as they pleased, and that pretty much started at any age. According to Levi's older sister, Prairie, Scott often encouraged all of his children to do drugs and drink. She recounted a time when Levi set her room on fire when he was just 4 years old because he had become very angry with her. Levi also shared with a 48-hour special correspondent that his father handed him his first gun when he was 7 years old. One of Levi's most disturbing experiences in his life happened the day his father handed him that gun. Scott drove Levi out to a field while he carried a box of puppies. He then used the puppies as target practice. Levi was so angered over this that he ran away and held a grudge against his father for a very long time after the incident. Scott was not a supportive father and often took his anger out on his children, but particularly on Levi. Growing up, Levi was sent away to various psychiatric hospitals where he expressed that he had suicidal tendencies. At age 10, he followed the instructions of his father and began partaking in alcohol and marijuana. At age 11, he confessed that he had been hearing voices speaking to him over the phone. When he became a teenager, he indulged in various drugs that further exacerbated his psychosis. When Levi arrived at his father's home after running away from the halfway home, Scott rebuffed him and told him that he wasn't welcome in his home. Levi asked his father if he could just give him a ride to the nearby bus station the following morning, and Scott agreed. On Wednesday, September 28th, Levi was supposed to meet with his father to head to the local bus station at 7:30 a.m. and leave town. But Levi had other plans. When his father fell asleep, his plan was put into action. He broke into his father's gun safe and pulled out a 9mm Smith & Wesson and other guns to take with him on his spontaneous journey. He packed it in his bag and decided to look for a vehicle to make his getaway. He spotted the red 1995 Dodge Dakota pickup that belonged to 70-year-old Orly McCool. Levi initially had no plans to murder, but he was still angry with his father, and the only way his mind could compensate for the rejection was to kill. He needed that pickup to make his way towards Mexico and so help anyone who got in his way. Orly Wade McCool was born on February 23, 1935, in Jane, Missouri, to parents Chester and Elma McCool. He lived a fairly quiet life until he joined the U.S. Army in 1956, serving for a time in Japan. When his enlistment ended, he returned to the United States, where he would attend the Grantham School of Electronics in Kansas City, Missouri. He was an entrepreneur at heart, which led him to opening his own electronic shop and then later a restaurant called Stakeout Restaurant in 1984. He lived a quiet and very happy life in Anderson, Missouri, until September 30th, 2005. Orley maintained a great relationship with his former daughter-in-law, Laura Dawn Burr McCool, who simply went by Dawn. She was born on July 13th, 1958. In Neosho, Missouri, to Troy and Laura Burr. She graduated from Neosho High School in 1976. She began working for the home offices of corporate conglomerate Walmart in 1988. She enjoyed the position she was in and married Michael Wade McCool on April 8, 1977. They welcomed their son, Matthew McCool, a few years later. The couple eventually divorced amicably, and Dawn maintained a good relationship with her father-in-law, Orley, by helping him around his home. Orley loved Dawn very much and enjoyed her company. It was no surprise that Dawn was at his home that fateful day, performing various housekeeping tasks around the home and eventually going grocery shopping with Orley. Matthew McCool, Dawn's son, remembers his mother as a very loving and caring woman. His grandfather was especially supportive of him in all of his endeavors and was there for him when he lost his father on April 27, 2005. When Matthew received a call around noon on September 30, 2005 from a relative stating they couldn't reach Orley or Dawn, his heart sank. He tried not to think of the worst as he reached out to his mother several times that day. Eventually, he got in his car and made the drive to his grandfather's home to check on them. When he arrived at the home of his grandfather, Matthew found it to be eerily quiet. After he walked in, he immediately noticed his grandfather's bloody body just inside the front door, surrounded by groceries that had been purchased earlier that day. Shocked and overcome with grief, he yelled for his mother, but there was no answer back. He immediately called 911 to report the grisly scene. He anxiously waited outside of the home until authorities arrived. He told them what they would find inside. The sheriff's office secured the crime scene and collected various shell casings that looked drastically different than the shell casings you would normally find. Whoever shot the gun had access to very rare ammunition. Dawn's body was found at the foot of the stairs, where she likely attempted to run away from the gunman before being riddled with bullets. Orley was attacked upon opening the door for the stranger, which likely prompted Dawn's run for her own life. Levi King was responsible for the murders. Police wouldn't know that he was a suspect until a police officer who arrived after mentioned that a man by the name of Scott King reported just a day earlier that his son Levi had stolen an array of guns from his home, along with some very rare Russian ammunition. They reviewed the report and pictures taken in Scott King's home, and they matched them to the casings found in the McCool home. They now had a suspect. Matthew informed detectives that his grandfather's Dodge Dakota pickup was missing, along with a gun he kept in a cabinet for protection. Authorities quickly put out an APB or All Points Bulletin on the stolen truck. Levi King had already made his second stop on a deadly killing spree. While making his getaway in Orley's truck, he took Interstate 40 to Texas. He found his way onto a dark, isolated farm road on Highway 70. He found his way onto a dark and isolated farm road on Highway 70. Throughout the 6.5-hour road trip, Levi remembered a sense of peace washing over him. The feeling was euphoric and uplifting. When describing this feeling to a 48-hour special correspondent, he kept a smug look on his face. You would never think that he would use these words to describe how he brutally murdered two complete strangers in cold blood. The calm he felt was quickly washing away, and the urge to murder returned with a vengeance. He just wanted to feel happy again, like he felt the second he started Orley's truck and drove off. Levi found a rather large and isolated farmhouse. With no neighboring homes that could be seen from the roadway, Levi considered this to be the perfect hunting ground. He pulled into the long gravel driveway and grabbed the AK-47 he had stolen from his father's gun safe. He walked up to the front door and kicked it in. Michelle Conrad, who was 35 years old and 5 months pregnant, woke up from the burst and began to scream for her husband, 31-year-old Brian Conrad. Levi would also shoot the family dog, Molly, twice. Levi shot at Michelle 6 times before she finally succumbed to her injuries. The force from the AK-47 was so strong that it caused the fetus that she was carrying to be expelled from her abdomen. He shot Brian a total of 4 times, with the final shot landing in his temple. 10-year-old Robin Doan was startled awake by her mother's screams and crawled onto the floor to peek out the door. That's when she first saw the tall man clad in black, carrying a large gun. She was so frightened that she climbed back into her bed and pulled the covers over her, pretending to be asleep. He opened the door to Robin's room and shot at her twice. The bullets whizzed past her head, but she pretended to play dead and didn't even flinch when the second shot came her way. She let out a shaky sigh of relief when Levi closed her bedroom door. She heard his heavy footsteps make their way towards her older brother's room. 14-year-old Zach Doan was shot several times in the abdomen and let out a painful moan before another shot rang out, followed by silence. Levi was completely satisfied with what he had done. He rummaged through the kitchen to eat before making his way back to the truck. His plan was to head to the Mexican border. He knew that if he could make it to Mexico, they would not extradite him back to the United States. Mexico often refuses to extradite U.S. citizens if they will face the death penalty. Oftentimes, the United States is forced to take the death penalty off the table before Mexico will agree to turn them over. While Levi made the 7-hour trip to the Bridge of the Americas in El Paso, Texas, Robin Doan was working up the courage to get out of her bed. After several hours had passed and she was certain the man had left, she picked up the cordless phone in the living room and dialed 911 outside of her home. Listeners, please be aware that if you are sensitive to content in 911 calls, you should skip ahead about 1 minute and 43 seconds.
Sheriff's Office, 911.
Ma'am, There was a shootout in my house. I don't know who's alive in my house, and I'm scared.
Where are you at?
7142 Highway 70. It's about 13.3 miles out from the bowling alley.
What's your name?
Robin Doan. My parents are Conrad and Brian Conrad. I'm scared after this and I don't know what
Robin
to do.
Robin Doan?
Yes, ma'am.
Brian Conrad.
My mom is alive.
Okay, I'll stay on with you. I've got the ambulance and the fire department to come to, okay?
Thank you so much.
They're coming. Right there. You don't see any other vehicles or strange people around your home or anything?
No, ma'am.
You didn't see a car drive off of any kind?
No, ma'am.
You just heard the shots fired?
And I saw the lights on Instagram, so I'm assuming they stole some stuff.
Okay, okay.
I can't believe it.
Okay.
And all I want right now is my blanket and my pillow. I'm scared.
I know you are.
I'm scared.
I know. Just stay right there. Okay, he's there.
I hear more sirens.
Yes, they're coming. I've got the ambulance and the car coming for you, okay?
I want my mom.
I know you do. I know. There?
Yeah, I see another police car.
Okay, that's Janet. That's Elliot that's going to be there with you, okay?
Okay.
Robin Doan was approached by a policeman who quickly scooped her up and wrapped her in a blanket. Police began the long task of collecting evidence and delicately asking Robin the details she remembered about that morning. Authorities confirmed that she was the only survivor and had no idea who would have done such a heinous thing to a seemingly innocent family. A few theories were thrown about, like perhaps the Conrads were caught in the crosshairs of a drug deal. Perhaps the dealer selected the wrong house and accidentally killed the Conrads. It didn't make too much sense, but they attempted to address and dispel every theory until one stuck. The Conrad family was well-liked in the small town of Pampa, Texas, Michelle Sudarth Conrad grew up in Grand Prairie, Texas, but had moved to Pampa sometime in her early teens. She graduated from Pampa High School and was heavily involved in 4-H, which allowed her to raise and show various farm animals. She had two children with her ex-husband, Johnny Doan. First was Zachary Ryan Doan, born August 21, 1991. Zach was athletic and thoroughly enjoyed playing baseball, running track, and shooting his air rifle with his friends. Michelle's Christian faith was strong, and her family were proud members of the Briarwood Full Gospel Church. Robin Doan was born in 1995 and was the apple of her mother's eye. She grew to love being raised on a farm with her mother and stepfather, Brian Conrad, whom her mother married in January of 2003. Michelle was excited to be pregnant with her third child, a baby boy who the couple planned to name Michael. Their lives and futures were taken away that early morning by Levi King. It was, and remains true today, that it was a miracle that Robin Doan made it out of that house alive. Levi had finally made it to the Bridge of the Americas in El Paso, Texas. He pulled up to the stall and declared that he had guns. The Border Patrol agents granted him passage. He was relieved to finally be across the border. Now he was completely home free, or so he thought. Levi entered into Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, but promptly made a wrong turn that essentially put him back on the track to the Bridge of the Americas. He realized his mistake too late and was forced to pull up to the stall. He informed the agent that he was turned around and would just do a U-turn to get back into Mexico. However, his luck had just run out. The plates were run in the database after Levi declared that he had guns in the back. When the truck came back as stolen, and the suspect possibly being involved in a homicide a day earlier, he was promptly arrested. El Paso police began to question Levi about how he gained possession of that vehicle. They had notified Missouri police to inform them that they had Levi in custody. Missouri police quickly got on the road and made their way to El Paso. It would only take 15 minutes for Levi to confess to the murders of Orly and Don McCool.
Before I even realized it, I mean, I just pointed the hat in the fire.
How many times did you fire?
Just once. He spun over.
You walk by to the door and you see this woman. Why, explain to you why you shot at her.
I was scared. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. You know, I was panicking.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. When the Missouri PD arrived in El Paso, they retrieved him and headed back home. Levi continued his confession during the car ride and told detectives that he could still smell the blood and gunpowder mixture in the air, and that it was the best feeling he had ever had, better than any high a drug could ever give him. He was charged with the deaths of Orly and Don McCool within the week, but Levi wasn't done dropping bombshells upon the detectives. Almost a week after the deaths of the Conrad family, Levi requested to speak to a detective. When the detective approached him, Levi said coolly, "You know, there are four more in Texas." When probed further about the location, he said he couldn't remember the name, but recalled seeing a large cross before he turned down the road to the Conrad home. The detective luckily knew exactly what city he was describing, Pampa. Evidence retrieved from Orly McCool's stolen truck revealed a name tag belonging to Brian Conrad. Levi King was now responsible for the deaths of five people. He discovered much later that 10-year-old Robin Doan had survived the attack. Levi King was charged with the murders of the Conrad family, but since he was detained in Missouri, he would have to face the court system there before he could be tried in Texas. On April 18, 2008, Levi King accepted a plea deal in the deaths of Orly and Don McCool. In exchange for pleading guilty, Levi was sentenced to 2 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. A year later, Levi would be extradited to Lubbock, Texas, to face capital murder charges for the deaths of Brian, Michelle, Michael, and Zachary. A charge of capital murder in Texas is typically brought forth with a death penalty. Levi entered a plea of guilty on September 4, 2009. Although the death penalty was on the table, Levi would likely never be put to death in Texas since he had to serve his time in Missouri for the McCool murders. During the sentencing phase, his defense team asserted that Levi was bipolar and was in a psychosis during the murders. His sister and his other family members attempted to provide mitigating circumstances, stating that his poor home life, the death of his brother Stephen, who was shot in the face by a friend, by a gun that was given to that friend by Levi's own father. After Stephen's death, Levi and other siblings were forced to shoot guns outside. Their father said, "Just because Stephen was killed with a gun, I don't want you to be afraid of guns." Admittedly, this was not the proper response to a child who had just lost their sibling. Prairie, Levi's eldest sister, stated that she was in shock over Levi's crimes, but that their father deserved to be seated next to Levi. After all, he was primarily responsible for the way his life turned out. The jury deliberated for 9 hours before concluding that they could not agree on the death penalty. Due to this, the judge sentenced him to life in prison. Levi was then transported back to Missouri, where he was to serve out his life sentence. Levi King is currently serving his sentence at the Eastern Reception Diagnostic Correctional Center, which is a medium to maximum level facility. Levi is in the medium security portion after prison officials determined that he was not a threat to other inmates, only to the public at large. Levi is given many freedoms in the prison. He spends the majority of his day out of the cell and is not regulated to a typical prison uniform. In an interview he gave in 2010 to Kristen Gilfoos of News 10 Missouri, Levi stated, quote, "There are some people who say I should have been hung on the courthouse lawn. I wouldn't necessarily shun anyone who says this isn't harsh enough. I can't necessarily argue with that." When asked why he chose the McCool or Conrad families, Levi shared, quote, "It's something that I still can't explain. You can read theories, sort of understand, I guess, a bit of logic and reasoning. There's one that really resonates with me. It was an outward way of expressing something I would have rather done to myself or have done to myself. All that pent-up aggression and rage, it all more or less came to the surface. One of the officers on the stand referred to it as being evil. There was a certain amount of that there. I didn't care about them, me, or any of it." Levi King, despite his crimes, is attempting to help those prisoners whose sentences will eventually lead to a release. Is this all a farce, or is Levi capable of making positive changes despite his egregious acts of violence against complete strangers? No one will ever know. It may take Levi's entire lifetime to determine if he's made any true changes, but will it matter? Robin Doan, despite the senseless and tragic loss of her family, went on to live with her father. She has given various interviews after turning 18 years old and has expressed eloquently and bravely how the loss of her family has impacted her life. She states that birthdays are particularly hard for her because she greatly misses her mother, stepfather, and brother. However, she carries their memory on by sharing her story to various news outlets. She was featured in a 48-hour special and a CBS special where she shares her story of survival. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, TCFCpod@gmail.com. Music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check him out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Content editing and research provided by Brittany Martinez.